You're listening to Embodied Solidarities, 3CR's Disability Day broadcast, 855 AM on your radio.
I'd like to acknowledge that we are broadcasting on unceded Gadigal land. This land has been in the hands of generations of Gadigal custodians for thousands of years before us, and it will continue to be in their hands long after us. It's a meeting place for sharing knowledge, stories, and song, and we are privileged to be a part of that storytelling today and every day. I pay my respects to Gadigal elders, past and present. We're broadcasting from Redfern right now, the birthplace of Black theatre in this country, and a site for resistance and resilience for First Nations peoples. We honour this in all the work we do, and carry this into our conversation today. Today's episode is on disability justice, and we acknowledge that eugenics is foundational to the settler colony, and that disabled First Nations people bear the brunt of ableist violence. There is no disability justice without land back, from Gadigal to Gaza.
WHO has been assessing this outbreak around the clock, and we're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity, and by the alarming levels of inaction.
We're facing a once-in-a-100-year event. The last
you don't know how it transmits. Is it very easy to transmit?
I think it is right to be very cautious about the health
rolling
of Australia.
Series of events which will see people
move means it's now a matter
apart.
Of when, not
handshakes
if.
Handshakes are over, so social distancing.
More than 400 hospital staff and their families have been forced.
Human to human transmission means this virus is potentially
the
a far bigger threat.
Is the biggest threat this country has faced for decades, and this country is not alone.
We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic. We have rung the alarm bell loud and clear.
My name is Samantha, and this is an episode about the ongoing COVID pandemic. It is a story about myself and the people I love, and what it feels like to be disabled and in disabled community at this moment. It is also a story about the world and what we choose to leave behind and how things could be different. It is a story made up of both silence and sound. The silence of what isn't being said anymore on the news, on social media, in everyday conversation. And the sound of the chorus of staunch disabled voices I was honoured to be able to bring together for this episode in hopes of filling some of that silence. In March 2020, when the pandemic first hit, time was ruptured for a moment. Schools, workplaces, and shopping malls were closed down. Major roads were eerily quiet. Things were uncertain. Things were not normal. But this was not all bad. Some part of this abnormality included new ideas. Ideas like, maybe our health is more important than our jobs. Like maybe our lives are not as independent as they seem. Like, maybe nothing about the world is fixed. Maybe things can change dramatically, even. In the uncertainty, there began the possibility to dream of a different sort of world. But soon enough, we were told by politicians, governments, and media that this whole thing was just a blip, and that getting back to normal was what we should focus on, was what we all needed. Normal. That's a word I think about a lot. What gets to be normal, and what gets to be a crisis, and when, and for how long? Supposedly, right now in 2024, we've gotten back to normal. That's been the narrative for the past 2 years at least. COVID is over, and we are back to normal.
But there's a question that we're maybe not asking.
Why is normal worth returning to? That's a question I want you to think about in this episode. Why is normal worth returning to? Especially when returning to a post-COVID normal has required us to leave behind, to abandon
so many people. I don't want to go back to normal. I don't want business as usual. I want to lean into transformation.
Yeah, that's what I've been dreaming of too.
Western capitalist individualism has long conditioned us to believe that our lives are individual, atomized things, driven by our own personal wants. But that short window, where COVID's transmissibility not only put a brake on the wheels of capitalist economy, but also on a personal level, forced many of us to engage with the fact that our actions impact others in important ways, and that we are strongest when we take care of one another. That short window changed everything, at least for a moment. I wonder, what if we got back there? What if we got back there and allowed it to transform us permanently and to build something better for the world, for each other? The pandemic cracked this small opening, this possibility, in the otherwise closed and dungeon-like ceiling of this colonial capitalist hellhole we live in. And they have been trying to close it back up ever since. But there are people who have been fighting like hell to keep it open and to crack it even wider. They are disability justice organizers, and this episode comes to you from them.
Nobody like a shit, doing it different. Nobody like a shit.
My name is Samantha Haran. Today, I am honored to be bringing together a chorus of voices to talk about the ongoing COVID pandemic and what it means to dream disability justice in this moment. You are about to hear from the incredible longtime disability justice writer and movement worker, Leah Lakshmi Piyapshana Samasinghe. I asked Leah, what is this moment we are in terms of COVID, but also more widely? And where is disability justice in it all? Here is Leah coming to us from Lenape country.
I was asked to speak a little bit about something I've talked about, which is this idea of the time we're living in, quote unquote, post-COVID era as being the great forgetting. And I don't think I'm the first person to come up with that. I first used it in an article that I wrote for Truth Out 2 years into the pandemic. And I started thinking about it actually that spring because I had been living for the first 2 years of the pandemic in Seattle, Washington, which at one point there was an article that was kind of obnoxiously titled, but it was accurate, that said nobody pandemics like Seattle, and it was kind of true in the States. So I was used to living in a city where, you know, not only were we on lockdown, there was really strict mask requirements and vaccine requirements. And really quickly, I found out that my mom, who had been in late stage dementia for a long time, was starting to actually decline. So I made a really rapid decision to move to Massachusetts to be closer to her in the last year of her life. What happened was I pulled over at a rest stop in New Jersey. And I was really in shock because I walked inside just to like pee and get a coffee. I was used to going to places where even if the customers weren't all wearing masks, the workers were, because they were like, we don't want to fucking die. Like, we are service workers. We're exposed to virus every day. We want to live. And I walked in and I was like, I feel like I'm in the Twilight Zone. No one's wearing a mask, which now is so unfortunately common, but at the time it was really shocking. And everyone was walking around like, what pandemic? Everything's normal. And was kind of staring at me like, you're wearing a mask, what's wrong with you? And I was like, wow. Not just that, but also this kind of overall societal feeling, including among people who would claim to be leftist or progressive or into social justice or radical, this kind of disassociation and denial. You know, the way I wrote about in the article, I'll just briefly quote it, by the great gaslighting or the great forgetting, I mean the immense on-purpose effort by the state to throw down the memory hole the fact that the last 2 years of the pandemic happened. The state is acting like a bad boyfriend, a gaslighting partner telling you that nothing you remember is real. I don't want to sound too conspiracy theory, but I do believe it is a deliberate effort from the state to look at the masses of people who have COVID, have long COVID, been touched by COVID, and to be like, no, we don't want to pay for this. We don't want to pay for your disability. We don't want to pay for your unemployment. $600 sent to us by the U.S. government, which is not a lot, but which is more than the U.S. government has ever sent anybody. You know, eviction moratoriums, policies where, oh, you're sick and you're supposed to get on an airplane. Don't worry, stay home. You won't lose your ticket price. You know, flexibility for some workers with working from home, flexibility about cancellation, telehealth, many of which are accessibility accommodations that disabled people and parents and elders have asked for years and not gotten. And so many of us in disabled communities were like, wow, the first 2 years of the pandemic were some of the most accessible times that any of us had our whole lives. And there was a lot of both sweetness and bitterness that, wow, you know, when abled people need it, all of a sudden you can get captions, you can get Zoom, you can get hybrid stuff, you can, you know, go to school from home. There's lenient absence and sick policies. You can totally eat outside. When I talk about the Great Forgetting right now, it's this real campaign to erase pandemic memory and also erasing both the fact of the millions of people who died, the millions of people who, as one campaign calls them, are millions missing because they are severely chronically ill and disabled with long COVID, and they are home and they're bedbound and they're really disappeared from public society. Back to, you know, this ye old standard ableist way of like, oh, you know, if you're sick, just stay home in your bed. Like, you don't get to go to a concert or a restaurant or a bookstore. You don't get to be in public. And we see this subtly. We see this in, you know, passively and like kind of social death in hospitals, for example, refusing to ask their staff to mask, even during, as we're seeing right now, really high surges of pandemic activity, of COVID. We're seeing it in the erasure of data. Now there's just not even any data. Like, so many places are not even tracking COVID cases at all. What we have is wastewater data, which thankfully is very accurate. But I got COVID for sure in May of 2024 because I traveled to California to go to some COVID safer events, and we all tested and we had air purifiers, and I still got it because I got it from asymptomatic transmission from someone who had tested negative. And I've watched over the past 4 months as so many people I know getting this variant, and the only places that talk about it really are places like the People's CDC, the Sick Times, Long COVID Justice, like other popular movements for COVID justice and disability justice. There's not really any state acknowledgement of it. And you get to the point where Biden himself, several weeks ago, comes down with COVID, you know, for I don't know how many times he's had it. And he's still there at the top of Air Force One saying, I'm, you know, waving with no mask on. There's just such a level of disassociation and see no evil, hear no evil, smell no evil.
The Great Forgetting is erasing the past few years from collective memory. This means erasing the announcement of COVID. And it also means erasing the radical organizing that happened alongside and soon after that announcement.
Post the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, many other Black folks, many of whom were disabled by the cops in the state, we saw massive uprisings for racial justice and against Black genocide and against anti-Black racism all over North America. Where I was living in Seattle, there was a, God, I think 6 month encampment where we took over a really big 10 block chunk of a major neighborhood downtown, including a police precinct. I believe that the government and the state has a very vested interest in making sure that we forget that that kind of revolutionary activity happened and that things felt really fucking different and that we're really different. They don't want to pay for it, and they know it is a threat to their authority, control, and profit. Sins Invalid, which is a foundational disability justice organization in the Bay Area of California, we were really clear that we were like, disability justice is a movement led by Black, Indigenous, and people of color who are disabled, and our disability justice issues are things like war, imperialism, colonization, genocide. It's not just like, oh, you know, put a ramp on the White House and everything will be fine. It's like no business as usual. They are also people who are resisting, fighting back, part of the resistance, cultural workers, organizers, educators, parents, children, like all of the above. There has been a history of sometimes that language of like, oh, you know, these poor disabled people who are disabled in our communities, we're also resistors, we're also agents of change, is what we were trying to say.
You're listening to Embodied Solidarities, 3CR's Disability Day broadcast, 8:55 a.m. on your radio.
One of the principles of disability justice that I've thought about a lot through the pandemic is interdependence. We meet each other's needs as we build towards liberation. Nobody or mind can be left behind.
It makes me think about something I've seen a lot online in the last 4 months of the flirt variant, where there's been different messaging being put out there online where people are like, if you stop wearing a mask, you know, it's not too late to just start again. You could just start. And I would say it's never too late if you like eased up on community care and love to just start doing it again.
Heads up, this one has a language warning.
To Love and Die by Janae Iker. Today, we are talking about the ongoing COVID pandemic through the lens of disability justice. Disability justice is about transforming the fabric of our world. It's about making things differently.
It's about creating space where space was denied. Next, we are honored to hear from two different disability justice projects that are doing just that, here in so-called Australia. Six Sovereign and the Disability Justice Network. Six Sovereign is a powerful zine by disabled First Nations people, documenting their experiences of the pandemic. The Disability Justice Network is a group led by and for multiply marginalised disabled people across so-called Australia, working towards a world grounded in disability justice. Here's Darcy from Six Sovereign, followed by Tori Hobbs and Julia Rose Back from the Disability Justice Network.
As I write this, I struggle to recall the last time I left the house for reasons beyond taking out the bins, checking the mail, attending an appointment, or going to the pharmacy. I struggle to recall the last time I socially engaged with friends. I don't even bother to remember the last time I felt safe in a social setting. It's hard to imagine that there was ever a time when being around people didn't involve constant assessment and reassessment of risk, asking myself the same question over and over and over. Is this worth risking my life for? I question the validity of my identity more than ever before. Physical presence and connection is an integral part of culture, of fostering and maintaining community and kinship. Am I really even mob if that's something I can't do? Do I have any right to claim blackness at this distance? The divide between myself and everything around me feels bigger each day. COVID would likely be a death sentence for me. Isolation is a safety mechanism I use to keep myself alive. But it is not a choice. It is a product of existing within structures of colonialism, capitalism, and white supremacy that position people like me as better off dead. But neglecting, ignoring, and even sacrificing oppressed communities during a crisis while positioning their illness and death as inevitable, even a relief, that is a choice. That is a deliberate and calculated choice. It is a choice that communities rendered insignificant and undesirable are forced to witness being made again and again every single day. This is a snippet of what existing at the intersection of blackness and disability amidst a global pandemic means for me. What it means for me, though, is not the same as what it means for the next disabled blackfella, or the one after that, or after that. There is, of course, no one all-encompassing disabled black experience. Our perspectives are broad, complex, diverse, messy, undefinable, and distinct. And yet, we rarely see any disabled First Nations experiences represented at all, let alone in all their nuanced glory. This is why I wanted to create Six Sovereign, because disabled First Nations perspectives deserve and need visibility. Multiply marginalised people continue to be sidelined in discussions around and responses to COVID. We are still finding ways to express how we fit into the pandemic world. We deserve for our expressions to be informed by our communities, not just the dominant colonial, capitalist, white supremacist perspectives that reduce us to a deficit, a nuisance, a problem to be solved. We deserve access to understandings of the world that have been shaped by lived experiences like our own. In these expressions, we can find solidarity, connection, shared experiences, and language and representations to identify with. Six Sovereign exists to create a space that we have been denied. It is a collection of stories from young, disabled First Nations people situating themselves in relation to COVID and vaccination. It is not an attempt to position any single perspective as factually or morally superior or correct. There is no wrong or right way to experience a global crisis. These stories encapsulate experiences of pain, struggle, loss, isolation, joy, abundance, strength, uncertainty, confusion, excitement, apathy, numbness, regret, and so much more. They are unedited, unabridged, undiluted accounts of just some of the limitless possibilities of what it means to be young, black, and disabled in a global pandemic.
This pandemic has shown the lack of care the government and the abled community have towards disabled people and highlighted our disposability when capital and abled comfort is at stake. In the lead up to this forum, members of DJN met because we were tired and traumatized. We've been online sharing in our collective mourning for our community. And lately we've been coming across cries from abled people, a call to action when action has already been ongoing. Why is no one speaking of this and what can we do? We felt disgusted and defeated. All the work disabled people have been doing these past 2 years was erased again and again. We've borne the brunt of this pandemic and we faced an infinite number of barriers to the care that we need and the care that we deserve. Discrimination from a government who's deemed our lives unworthy of protecting and abled friends who've done the same. We've been disposed of, and through it all, we've tried our hardest to survive and care for one another. Knowing the threat of further disability, hospitalization, and death is knocking on our door, in the face of pro-eugenics rhetoric and everything else, our care for each other has kept us alive. COVID is a massive mass disabling event for abled people and a mass death event for disabled people.
I think part of what we've seen recently, I suppose since the start of the pandemic, but especially now that a lot of people have come out of lockdown, is it feels like during the extended lockdowns that were imposed in Victoria, New South Wales in particular, a lot of able-bodied people got a glimpse at what it's like to live as disabled and immunocompromised people, in the sense that they were isolated, they saw what it was like to have healthcare be inaccessible, they understood, to some scale what it's like to fear illness and to fear an exacerbation of symptoms. And their response to this glimpse into the life of disabled and immunocompromised people is so much so that they don't want to be like us, that they're willing to sacrifice us to live the lives that feel comfortable to them. It's glaringly obvious how rampant ableism and eugenics are in the world at the moment. And it feels like the only thing that has been able to bring me any kind of joy in these times is building community and building relationships with other disabled people. And there are so many disabled people who have spoken tonight that I have shared much fewer words with than some of my closest friends, but I would feel so much more comfortable going to them for support and for solidarity because I know that we get it.
But I've got my love, and though we turn in, I notice no rotation. You're for me, I'm fixed on you. Hold you closely. Together we'll blow. I've been waiting all so long for a reason, whether it's right or wrong. I was slipping, now I know that there's no dipping from responsibilities. I hold no hostility for me, for you to inherit or seek out. From young we will speak out. I have traveled though so far to receive you. I'm not there yet, but I see you with a clear view. I welcome you as sacrament, the grace you bring. I've only prayed for it. It's you I adore.
world is running, but I've got my love, though it's concerning. I feel no aggravation. You came for me, and I for you. You closely, together we'll bloom. I've been waiting all my life to feel love like this. I can't deny I'm running up and down in my mind. I think of you all the time. I need you here, want you now. You've manifest. I don't know how. This is life. You are mine. What a blessing to align. Sow your seeds in the springtime, watch as they come alive. I can't wait to see you grow, I long to see you thrive. A blessing bestowed upon me, a wonder so divine. Heavenly navigation has brought our lives intertwined. The world is burning, but I've got my love. And always turning, I notice no rotation. You're for me, I'm fixed on you. Hold you closely, together we'll blow. The world is burning. The world is burning. The world is burning. But I got my love. I got my love. I got my love. I got my love.
You're tuned into Embodied Solidarities, 3CR Community Radio's 2024 Disability Day broadcast, 3cr.org.au, 3CR Digital, 855am on your dial.
At the start of the pandemic, I didn't have any consciousness about disability justice. I think I had thought about disability in terms of accessibility in quite a flawed and superficial way.
Disability justice means transforming the world, but it also means transforming ourselves. When we say the pandemic is a portal, that is a call to step through the portal and come out the other side radically changed, to let it transform you. My name is Samantha Haran, coming to you today alongside a chorus of voices from disability justice organizing groups from across the globe, reminding us that transforming the world is not done alone. Our lives are deeply interconnected, and so is our liberation. That is why a few friends and I came together last year to start COVID Solidarity SID, a disability justice collective focused on community COVID care. You're going to hear from my friend Lee from the collective. Lee has been a transformational person in my journey with disability justice and COVID politics over the past few years. Here's the two of us speaking through this journey and how we are bringing COVID justice into our day-to-day lives.
A lot of disabled, particularly chronically ill, and then also immunocompromised people really taught us how to survive lockdowns or how to navigate them in ways where we can still maintain connection and meet some of our needs. And I think that engaging with that made me realize how many people I was leaving behind in my worldview and who I subconsciously thought was disposable, even though perhaps in my words or in my my rhetoric, I was saying like, oh, we leave no one behind, but I think I was leaving a lot of people behind. And then I think as I myself became more disabled with ME, I have connected more and more with disability justice in a very personal way as well. It made me reflect more deeply on my own complicity as a settler in the settler colony as well of so-called Australia, in terms of like disease and the spread of disease was such a crucial part, or like such a big part of the colonial project. And in my head, this was just kind of like another continuation of it.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And that really resonates with me as well. Like this sort of the start of the pandemic was definitely when I also first really started seriously engaging with disability justice. And these past few years have also coincided with my own sort of journey with understanding myself as disabled. And I think that that initial sort of moment when, you know, pandemic started and there was a lot of conversations about disability justice and community care and sort of the politicization of health, I think we also, something that was really, I think, radicalizing for me was seeing the ways that different sort of basically accessibility measures that were put in place in like a broader way were liberatory for everyone. And I think that's what disability justice teaches, right? It's like disability justice frees all of us.
I feel like kind of liberal progressive communities, I saw a lot of people take up making sure that everyone got vaccinated as a ticket to like freedom, quote unquote. And there was kind of this moral judgment attached to vaccination that I think wasn't always warranted, because I feel like sometimes vaccination was like this easy way of showing solidarity that then exempted people from thinking about how they could actually be in solidarity and care for disabled people. And now we understand that COVID affects everybody, and everyone is at risk of complications, quote unquote, long COVID, death. That was a lot of the rhetoric. Everyone was like, the world is changing. The world is never going to be the same. And then very quickly after, everyone's like, how can we get back to normal? How can we get back to the same stuff?
Yeah, completely. I think that's something that I think about all the time, like that really early pandemic, these sort of like radical ideas about, hey, like, look, they can actually stop parts of the economy, and that's actually possible. And like, we can actually take time off work. We can work from home. These things can happen. And you know, it's not the end of the world, because there's this sort of, you know, capitalist realism where it's like, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. But in that moment, obviously it wasn't ended, but there was some fracturing, and there's some real fracturing that really gave a lot of insight into how these mechanisms work and who's in control. Like even the ideas around at the beginning of the pandemic, like who is an essential worker, and it's not the financial analyst on $300K a year who gets, you know, compensated the most. Like that is not an essential worker. And I think something that was really highlighted in that moment was that the work that is needed to like actually sort of like basically keep the world running is the most underpaid, undervalued work. And it is also a very small amount of like sort of where money is going. And I think that was a real moment of possibility for people to really think about anti-capitalism in this really serious way. And for a moment, I think people were, like, I think there was this real opening, but it was closed so quickly. When the pandemic was declared to be over, it was the sentiment from the governments wasn't even that COVID is gone. It was that COVID only affects the vulnerable, so like, don't worry about it. But like, even taking like the sentiment, like exactly as they said it, like even not analyzing like the fact that that's actually obviously not true as we know, but even if that was true, COVID only affects the vulnerable. Why is that an appropriate cost to pay? Like, why is that certain people's lives there? That's like an okay sort of cost to pay for us to get back to normal. And also this idea of like, what is this normal that we're returning to? Like, what is good about it?
Earlier pandemic, we were really talking about, we don't want to return to normal, that it exacerbated existing gaps in the system and I think made a lot more people conscious or more conscious of the ways that settler colonialism and capitalism is so deeply embedded in all of our lives. It felt like it kind of broke through some of the illusions that we live under every day for some of us. And yeah, that rhetoric was just so quickly dropped. But also, I think I did have a lot of difficulty on a personal level, just perhaps grappling with people being like, oh, I don't want to care about COVID precautions anymore, as things were starting to open back up and as the government stopped caring. People saying, oh, I just don't want to care about this anymore because I need to put my mental health first. And I think that mental health is very important. But as someone who was experiencing like the psychiatric hospital admissions and who had to be in isolation because of community transmission that wasn't being mitigated by precautions, people weren't taking them properly anymore, it was just really frustrating to feel like, well, mentally ill folks and mad folks, people who identify as mad, which I do, were bearing the brunt of that. Like it just felt very disingenuous. And I feel like the question should be, how can I take care of myself in a way that doesn't harm other people? How can I take care of myself in line with lifting us all up? And similarly, also knowing the immense restrictions that were in place in New South Wales prisons for so long, and even now there are still so many restrictions and the conditions that people put in, some of the reasons why people being put in isolation was because of like community transmission. So it's just frustrating to be like, we're opening back up, but all these people that we purported to care about are bearing the brunt of this.
So COVID Solidarity SID has been around for just under a year now, and a lot of what we were hoping to do with it is connect a COVID-conscious politic with broader liberation work. What drew you to wanting to start a collective like this at this point in time?
It was just feeling a lot of despair at people moving further and further into pandemic denialism, and also wanting to channel those feelings of hopelessness into actually making tangible change and recognizing some of the material barriers that people might have in being able to acknowledge what's happening around us. I think it's really easy to be like, oh, you just don't care because you're like a bad person, or you don't care about disabled people or whatever. But I also think that there are a lot of like tangible barriers to like masking, to air filters and things like that that can actually be addressed or that we should work towards addressing. And so I think that I really wanted to move towards building.
Yeah, I think that's really beautiful. And also like what really resonated with me when we kind of started having those initial conversations. I think when we met, it was like this really, it's really cool moment. I think we were all like sort of in this similar mind, sort of mental place of being like, we should do something. But I think especially like post like 2021, I think sort of practicing a COVID conscious politic has felt very isolating. So I think the idea of starting a collective to bring sort of like space together felt really important.
I definitely think that meeting you and the others has been such a like a life affirming thing, or like something that really brings like hope, like maybe hope affirming.
And I think that that is also a lot of like what I've learned from disability justice. Like I think we both talked about sort of being early on in our journeys with understanding disability justice, and so much of like that history is like history of people coming together when, you know, it is difficult, and like being really super creative. And I think it's been really, really cool to sort of like try and tap into that thing of being like, instead of feeling like a great despair, like how can we be creative in this moment, and how can we sort of, yeah, like channel our like sort of strong emotional feelings into like basically building something, as you said. To elaborate on that, what would you say are the sort of main goals of the work we're doing? Like, what do you think of as being what we're focusing on?
I feel like that our main goals are connecting people's existing kind of progressive or radical politics, not conflating the two, but to COVID consciousness and getting people to think about disability justice, because often COVID precautions are talked about in this very neutral health sense, in a way that kind of removes like concepts of health from the context that we live in, or people are like going to denialism. So I think just connecting people back to rhetoric that they were previously connected to but kind of had dropped, and like getting people to think about why. The other is distributing resources, so distributing masks and also connecting people. I think we're also moving more into like having meetups and things like that, so more practical things as well.
As you said, like, it is easy just to feel like people should just do better, but there is a lot of stuff about COVID that is necessarily sort of exacerbating existing sort of material access issues that were already there, but COVID sort of brings them into sort of like more intensity.
Yeah, it's also like looking at how do we respond to this in a way that is in line with the community care, because like, for example, when precautions were much more widespread and also state sanctioned or like state enforced, the ways that it was happening was incredibly like unequal. And so it's like there were lockdowns, but lockdowns for who? Who was able to lock down? Who was able to have food delivered to their home? Who could afford that? Who could afford to take time off work and things like that?
Yeah, so some of our work at the moment is about sort of doing like our own sort of public health information. And a lot of that has been focused on the fact that there's a real lack of updated information for people, so that there's really not much understanding about A, how COVID is transmitted, like what to do if you get it, all these sort of important questions, like important material questions. What does COVID conscious practice look like in your everyday life?
I mask in all indoors public spaces. And when friends come over and we hang out indoors, we both do a RAT. Obviously, this is a very imperfect one because rats are not very accurate or sensitive, especially if you're asymptomatic. And also, I understand that there's a lot of barriers to masking for many people as well, like not just cost, but also sensory needs. If you're deaf or hard of hearing, it can be a barrier as well. So also like with that in mind, my precautions are really flexible depending on who I'm around as well and stuff.
Even these sort of like simple precautions can feel really challenging when it is an isolating thing to commit to. So I also wanted to ask you, what sustains you in this practice every day?
I think it probably sounds really cheesy, but just the idea that we're all connected and that no one is disposable. I think about who, when we open up or when we stop taking precautions, who is forced into lockdowns continuously, who is continuously isolated. I think that what sustains me is a sense of accountability. There are times where I feel, oh, this is very inconvenient. Maybe I should just, you know, like stop caring. But I feel like it feels really disingenuous to have learnt from so many disabled, immunocompromised people and then discard those learnings when it's no longer convenient for me. So a lot of what drives it is community care and not wanting to go back on my learnings. I think that for me, a lot of the practice of love and care is accountability, is looking at some of the systemic or structural or like broader conditions and the ways that I might be complicit in them that make life hard for the people I love and for people around me that I love that I might not even know who have shaped my life. Increasingly so, I'm also so grateful for all the, you know, disabled folks who have shaped disability justice that have then shaped my politics, my understanding of life, and allowed me to live in a way that is much more in line with honoring my body and my capacity and loving the people around me with more authenticity. And so I think, again, like accountability to them as well.
Yeah, that really resonates. And I think like, you know, I think something that sustains a COVID politic is also what sustains like a liberation politic in general, like this real belief that like life is precious and that means everyone's lives, and what do we have to do in order to bring about a world where that is actually really realized. And I think like I remember we were once like talking about this sort of like visual imagery of like the transmission chains, and it's like just like one person can interrupt a transmission chain that could have resulted in like a death or like some really really difficult consequences for someone. And I always think like, you know, when people ask, like, are you just going to mask forever? Like, you know, I always think, like, if I mask for the rest of my life and I've only interrupted one transmission chain that would have killed one person, like, that is enough for me.
I'm Samantha Haran. This episode was made possible by a constellation of people. Thank you especially to Sharika Halaludin, Sahej Kaur, Justin Chen, Leah Lakshmi Pepsna Summersinger, Tori Hobbs and Julia Rose Back from the Disability Justice Network, Darcy from Six Sovereign, Lee from COVID Solidarity SID, and Juliet Fox and the team at 3CR Radical Radio down in Nam. No body or mind left behind. Moving together, we keep us safe.